Who by water? Who in the sunshine? Who in the nighttime? Who by high ordeal? Who by common trial? Who in your merry, merry month of May? Who by very slow decay? And who shall I say is calling?
Hello out there, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tim Banal. Welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio, Season 1. This week, we talk to Greg Bishop. He's the author of Project Beta, the story of Paul Benowitz, national security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth. For those of you who aren't familiar with the book, it's an examination of the story of Paul Benowitz, who was a UFO investigator, who thought he'd stumbled upon a UFO outbreak, if you will, at Kirtland Air Force Base, tried to contact the Air Force there, and eventually fell under the influence of government disinformation agents. It's a fascinating story, it's a human interest story, and it's one of the most talked about UFO books of 2005, so I was very excited to get Greg Bishop on the show to talk about it. This is part one of two. It was a lengthy interview. It lasted over the course of 2 days, so there's a slight bit of continuity issues here in the interview a little bit, but hopefully you won't even notice it, but I wanted to point it out. The interview was recorded on August 23rd and 24th, and here's a little bit about Greg Bishop outside of his authoring of Project Beta. He's also the editor and publisher of The Excluded Middle. That's a journal dealing in various aspects of esoterica. And he's also the host of Radio Misterioso, that is an online esoteric radio show. His website is www.excludedmiddle.com, excludedmiddle.com. So he's knowledgeable in many aspects of the world of esoterica and much of the stuff we cover on banalofamerica.com. So he's perfect for Banal of America Audio Season 1. So let's rock and roll. Greg Bishop on Banal of America Audio Season 1.
Ladies and gentlemen of Banal of America Audio, I'm pleased to announce we have a very special guest this week. He's the author of Project Beta, the story of Paul Benowitz, national security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth. And he also publishes and edits The Excluded Middle. It's a journal on UFOs, conspiracy research, psychedelia, and new science. And you can find that at www.excludedmiddle.com. He's Greg Bishop. Greg, thanks for giving me the time to talk and give the message out to the people at banalofamerica.com.
No problem. Sounds like it's going to be great. Let's go.
All right, let's do it. Now, you've been in the UFO field for a while, so what? Eventually you must decide you're going to write a book. What made you decide to write the book about this Paul Benowitz case?
Well, the short answer was that Simon & Schuster said yes to that proposal. The long answer is I'd known Bill Moore since the late 80s, in fact, about a year before he made that incredible announcement at the MUFON convention there in 89. And since he would talk to me, you know, privately about the case and what was going on, that was one of the proposals I sent out, you know, amongst four or five. And through Patrick Wage, who runs Paraview Press, he got that to Simon & Schuster through his deal, and that was one of the projects I said yes to, and I was happy because that's one of the main ones I really wanted to write about.
And how did you go about investigating? You say you're friends with Bill Moore, so did you get a lot of the stuff from him, and did you interview
Moore? I got a lot of stuff from Bill at first. Actually, throughout the course of the writing the book, he lives about 2 miles from me, so we'd just go out to lunch.
Huh.
And he would, you know, I'd say, hey, I'm at this stumbling block or whatever. Can you give me any direction? And he said, well, why don't you call this person this person?
Oh.
And, you know, he kind of smoothed the path with me for people that he knew that were involved with the story, like Rick Doty and a few other people. And these are people both inside and outside the government, which is why I thought, you know, I wouldn't be taken for a ride because I could check, you know, from some, you know, Richard Doty would tell me, we did this at this point and Paul went to this place. So I'd go to Gabe Valdez or somebody that I knew that knew him or had met him and said, you know, without leading them too much, would say, you know, did you ever hear about Paul Benowitz talking about X, you know, going out to this place and looking for whatever. Oh, yeah, he told me he went out there, and so, and then he showed me the pictures, and, you know, and if I could get that kind of confirmation, or some kind of document or newspaper article or something like that, that was separate from what supposedly a military intelligence insider would tell me, then I would feel fairly confident to put that in the book.
All right, and throughout the book, it seems like Benowitz, he's going more and more crazy. The people in ufology at the time, when did they realize that Benowitz was going down a wrong path?
Well, it depends. You know what, it really depended at the time, if you're talking about in the from the early 80s to the late 80s, it depended on what their preset, what their expectations were. Now, if somebody was really interested in the sensationalistic aspects of the story, like there was an underground base at Dulce, there was an agreement with the aliens to abduct people in exchange for technology, people like John Lear and...
Bill Cooper.
Bill Cooper, people like that, Bill English, a lot of Bills. They would kind of believe it without hesitation because that's what they wanted to hear and that's what they wanted to say in their lectures. But then there were other people like Bill Moore and like Stanton Friedman and who would kind of step back and say, well, you know, is there any other confirmation for this kind of, for these kinds of stories? And they tended to believe that, especially Bill because he knew what was going on, Bill Moore. They tended to think that he didn't really have too good of a filter on about what he would believe and what he wouldn't. So really, like I said, it really depended on what the people wanted to get out of him. He was kind of like a Rorschach blot for the ufologists at that point. And one faction went off and dealt with the weird story, and the other faction kind of took, you know, were a little bit more circumspect and just waited to hear if he said something that they could check out and sounded like it might have some validity to it. And that's almost how it remains, although I find that people are a little less polarized about Benowitz right now because of the passage of time. I mean, this was, 25, almost more than 25 years ago.
All right, based on the story presented in the book and Doty's interaction with Benowitz, how he was feeding all these stories sort of led his evolution of his theory, and your own investigation, do you think there's little credence to the popular concepts? And I have three listed here. Let's just start with MJ-12. Do you think there's any, the classic MJ-12 of ufology, do you think there's any credence to that, or do you think it's pretty flimsy?
Depends who you talk to. I personally believe, from what I've seen, that the case for an actual group called MJ-12 is pretty good. The case for that it had to do with UFOs covering them up and creating a story to tell to the public, I think the evidence for that is not so good. Now, if you talk to Bob and Ryan Wood, or, of course, Stanton Friedman, they would tell you differently, and they might be able to cite much better sources than I have for their views. But then if you talk to Bill Moore, who was essentially the first person to see these things, him and Jamie Chandray in 86, I believe, 1986, when it was mailed to Jamie's house. Bill, for his part, would probably be of the same opinion as I was from what he has seen, is that it's probably a hoax, but a pretty good one based on a group that actually did exist.
Yeah.
It does not exist now. That's as much as I can say on it. I'm not going to pound the podium and say, I mean, that's why my magazine is called Excluded Middle. I'm going to reserve judgment until I see something that unequivocally tells me that there's good evidence for one or the other side. And like I said, I'm kind of leaning towards the, you know, it existed, but if it had anything to do with UFOs, I'm not certain of that. And that actually was something that Benowitz was, he never really promulgated that theory because the stuff wasn't mailed to him, and he wasn't really interested in that. He was so interested in what was going on in New Mexico and his view of things and what he had found and what he had been shown and led to. He didn't really care too much about this MJ-12 thing, and that was direct fallout from getting those documents was direct fallout from Bill more cooperating with these sources at the, in the Air Force Office of Special Intelligence and the Defense Intelligence Agency. That was his part of the deal. He kept tabs on people and reported what their beliefs and findings were to whoever he had to. And in return, he got these UFO documents. He got lots of them. The Carter briefing document, which people have probably heard about, and the Aquarius document, which he actually showed to Paul Benowitz and told him to take it with a grain of salt, which he actually did. In fact, researchers have told me that Paul never said, look, here's something that proves that the government knows what I'm doing and supports it. But he would say it, but he wouldn't use the document to back it up, which is kind of strange, which either means he thought it was false or he took Bill's advice or a little of both.
Now, was he... That leads me to a side question here, then. Was he suspicious of information he got, or was he pretty gullible to whatever they gave him?
You know, from everybody I've talked to on both sides of the... When I say both sides, I mean the insider intelligence side and the ufologist, you know, basic general citizen, you know, U.S. Private citizen side. He was pretty gullible, and he would believe anything that propped up what he thought was going on and disbelieve things that would ignore things that tended to show that he was going down the wrong path. So he put his beliefs before the evidence consistently.
All right, and then another one of these things I was asking about that might have a little credence in light of all the research you've done and what we find out nowadays is the Dulce underground bases.
However you want to pronounce it. Well, that's kind of a long story. It's gone into in detail in the book.
But yeah.
The short version of that, as short as I can make it, is Paul Benowitz began to believe that there was an underground base in New Mexico. The reason he thought this is because he, very early on, in 1979-80 time frame, this woman was brought to his attention who said she had been abducted. And this was really early in the abduction, you know. There wasn't even an abduction craze yet. Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time, hadn't even come out yet. She thought she had been taken to some underground base. And for reasons that I was not able to figure out, because Benowitz was dead, or he died right while I was writing the book. My first visit to New Mexico, he had died like 2 weeks before.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I had to hear this from his son, who basically told me to get out of his office.
Now, do you think Benowitz would have talked to you if he was alive?
Oh, no. He was very sick and extreme. You know, he was old and very sick. I think he was 75 or 76, but he had been ill for probably a decade off and on.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, he thought there was this base there based on what this woman, Myrna Hansen, had told him in regressions, which were first done with Leo Sprinkle until he kind of got wary of Paul and his putting his emotions and his beliefs before the evidence attitude. When the Air Force heard that he had this strong belief there was an underground base, in order to keep his nose pointed away from Kirtland Air Force Base, where there actually were secret projects going on, they encouraged him in this direction and actually went to the trouble of getting him on a helicopter and flying him up to Dulce, New Mexico, over the Archuleta Mesa, where they had put props up. Now, a couple people have said, you know, you just believe Richard Doty when he told you that. And I said, no, Gabe Valdez told me the same thing. Paul had told him that. So I've got confirmation from somebody who has no interest whatsoever in covering up national secrets and, in fact, is against it. They took him up there and flew him over and showed him these little props they'd left up there. They were up high enough so you couldn't quite exactly tell what they were, but, you know, they were little tanks, fuel tanks and jeeps that were broken down. They just airlifted them up there. And apparently they'd also put, like, pipes sticking out of the ground and stuff, but I've never been able to confirm that. But as time went on, more and more people glommed onto this story, and I have yet to find anybody that actually saw anything there that looked like a base, besides Paul Benowitz and a few scattered people that swear there was something there, even though they've never been there, which is kind of amazing. I've had people swear to me, yes, there is a base there. Well, how do you know? And he says, well, I have good sources. Did you ever go there and look? Well, no, I didn't, but my sources I trust. I said, well, if you trust your sources, what did they find? Well, they found these, you know, ducts, these pipes sticking out of the ground. And I said, well, did they go up to them and find out, you know, see if they were just pipes sticking up, or were they buried very well in the ground? Was there air coming in or out of these pipes or ducts? That's, you could figure that was what was going on. Well, I don't know. I said, well, okay. Well, you have your beliefs, and I'm not gonna try. And obviously, you believe this without actually seeing it yourself, to the point where one guy said, I'd stake my life on it, even though he'd never been there.
Wow.
So it's very weird when you get into this area with people, and I don't want to, you know, say, well, you're full of crap and you're insane.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't think they are. I just think they want to believe that there's something there, and they've got enough people that they trust telling them so many different things, and this is one of them, that it fits in with whatever scenario that they've been able to uncover. So I don't know what to say to these people, except that there's very little evidence to me. And no, I didn't go up there. That's what they asked me to. Well, did you go up? I said, well, if there's nothing there, why should I go up there looking for it? It's a waste of time.
Yeah.
The onus is on you if you think there is something there to find it. Prove it to me and other people. So it gets very crazy sometimes. But yeah, I'm pretty much convinced that was made up. There were so many things they did to reinforce that. They even asked the Army Special Forces to go up there and start reinstituting their training in the air, Delta Force training in the area. So the people around Dulce, New Mexico, and the Mesa up there saw all these helicopters flying around and all these maneuvers and people, you know, jumping out of helicopters and you know, buzzing their farms and all this other stuff. So they truly believe there's something very important going on up there, but nobody's ever been able to find evidence of it except for, you know, like I said, these helicopters there and possibly something sticking out of the ground.
So that whole Dulce story, that all dates back pretty much to Benowitz, right? No one was talking about underground bases in Dulce before Benowitz.
No, that is the origin of that story, was Paul Benowitz and his idea that there was something there, and then, of course, the Air Force reinforcing that through lies and deceit.
And so you spent a lot of time with Bill Moore, and this is the third one of the concepts I wanted to ask you about, and that was Roswell. You know, what do you think about that? Obviously, you must have heard a lot about it from Bill, and I don't know, what do you think? Is there credence to the Roswell story?
Well, I don't know. Did you read Nick Redfern's new book?
Not yet, but I have actually. I've listened to the thing and, you know, done as much investigation of it as I can. There's only so many books I can read.
Yeah, there's only so many books I can read, things I can cover, and places I can go, personally, like you. But I don't know. I'm kind of up in the air on that, too. I tend to believe that if there was, that there's so much evidence there that something very strange did happen. Now, if it's, you know, deformed Japanese midgets in test gliders, like Nick says, that sort of fits with what went on, and it would explain a lot of the cover-up, because it was a whole, you know, it was not even borderline morally wrong, it just was wrong. You can put it down to, you know, post-war jitters and, you know, fighting the commies and all that. It seems to make sense to me. Now, I haven't done the research, and I don't know I don't know his sources. I don't know if they know each other, as Carl Flock has said. Carl actually is very much against Nick's book, which is very strange, since he wrote that book about the Mogul balloons.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
He just sent out an email saying that he thinks Nick's sources are disingenuous. They're somehow colluding to fool him. But as far as Nick is concerned, most of these people, in fact, all of the people he talked to, his main witnesses, as far as he could tell, had no knowledge of each other. I don't know how far up the chain he can go to check that out, and how long ago he can, you know, how long ago in the records he can check that out. But he was fairly convinced that that was so. Very intelligent people have been fooled by far less, though, so I don't know. As for Bill's part, I told him what Nick's book was about, and he pretty much poo-pooed it. He still thinks that something, I think he's fairly convinced that something strange and possibly extraterrestrial crashed in Roswell in 1947.
And he started investigating Roswell before he got involved with the government, to the best of your knowledge?
Oh, yeah, he did. In fact, that's how he came to the attention of the government, because
okay.
he read his book. He was at a radio station doing interviews for the Roswell incident, which came out in 1979. It's the first book on the Roswell incident that was ever written, and it brought all this to national attention at the time. He was at an interview in Albuquerque, and he'd already gotten one phone call from somebody saying, "We think you're the only person we've heard of that knows what they're talking about." You know, they were flattering his ego. And then the second time this happened, he was in Albuquerque, and he was able to go meet with somebody, and it turned out to be this Falcon character that I talk about in the book. Him and Richard Doty met with him for the first time in 1980, I believe, in Albuquerque, when he was doing a radio interview for the Roswell incident. And that's how that relationship started. And it was directly, as I said, a direct result of him writing the Roswell incident and being on the board of directors for APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, which is now defunct, but for many years was run out of Tucson, Arizona, by Coral and Jim Lorenzen, who actually play a part in the book, too.
Actually, then let me jump to that question, because I was going to ask you about APRO, because nowadays people only hear about MUFON. I was fortunate enough to hear Walt Andrus at this past X conference. He gave a fascinating sort of history of UFO organizations, but it sounds like you did a lot of research, and you were probably right in the thick of it with APRO. Tell me a little bit about APRO, because probably a lot of people haven't heard of it, because it's starting to fade from the memory of ufology.
I believe APRO actually split off from the Mutual UFO Network when it was the Midwest UFO Network. And Coral Lorenzen and her husband Jim moved to Tucson and started their own organization, which they thought would be a little bit more scientific and more, you know, grounded in their research. I think they began this in the mid-50s, I believe, and then they both put out many, many books about all the cases they'd worked on. They're great books. UFO Occupants was a good one. They broke the Vias Boas case for the first time. They were kind of nervous about it because it was a weird thing, a guy having sex with an alien woman. They were really nervous, apparently, about putting this out, but they did, and it was one of the first abduction cases on record that was actually investigated. Psychologists and doctors came into the picture, and this was spearheaded by APRO. And by the late 70s, they had asked Bill Moore to be on their board of directors, and he was moving from Michigan. I think he was teaching at the time, Minnesota, I'm sorry. And they asked him to be on the board based on the research he had done on the Roswell incident. And so he joined their board. He lived in, what's the name of the town? Prescott, Arizona, which is something like a 2-3 hour drive from Tucson. Strangely enough, George Hunt Williamson also lived in Prescott for quite a long time. One of the early contactees, and Bill knew a lot about him, too.
Huh.
Anyway, he got on the board there, and when the Air Force was basically out there fishing for people in the UFO community to use as contacts, Bill was one of the people that got one of their letters that they had concocted to try and see who would be receptive to such a thing, to cooperating with them. That was the Weitzel letter that was supposedly sent from Albuquerque in 1980 or 81,
okay.
I believe, about, it was some, you know, junior airman that had seen a UFO and then
yep.
seen some sort of landing and taken a picture, and then in the letter he said that some men in black came later and told him to shut up about it, and Bill actually called the guy up and he said, no, I saw something, but I didn't take any pictures and nobody came and told me to shut up, so Bill knew immediately it was a hoax. It was just sent to APRO. The same letter was sent to many different people. APRO got this letter, and Bill actually checked up on it. I think he was one of the only people that did, which is why he got the attention of the Air Force, because they wanted somebody who was careful about what they did, strangely enough.
Now, with APRO, when they closed down Isn't there like a story about how their records are like...
Oh, yeah, we got off the track. Yeah, a couple of people, I mentioned their names in the book, but I can't remember them, but some people that have been helping around the office took the records, put them, all the APRO files, put them in a garage, somewhere, storage space garage or somewhere in Tucson, and told everybody they couldn't have any access to them.
What's that all about?
I think they were just... They've got some kind of problem where they think they own the information, I suppose. I'm sure Coral and Jim Lorenzen are spitting in their graves when they heard about that.
I bet, yeah.
I don't know right. What happened to those records, if they've been released or what, but it was this couple. I don't know if they were married, you know, they had some sort of relationship, but they had been helping the Lorenzens, you know, kind of at the end there in the mid-90s, I believe, because they died within a few months of each other, the Coral and Jim. And I don't know what's happened to those records and if anybody's gotten them yet.
I don't think so, because I'm pretty sure that was one of the most interesting parts of what I heard Wally Andrews say, because I remembered it when I read your book, too. You mentioned it.
Yeah.
I think he said MUFON tried to buy them at one point, and they wouldn't sell them or anything.
Yeah, I don't know what their problem is, but they're not doing anything with the records.
That's the strange part. Yeah.
You know, something that's happened in ufology in the last few years, which I think is really interesting, is going into old cases and mining, massaging and mining the data to see if anything interesting comes up. And in a few cases, it has. That Rex Heflin picture from Santa Ana from the late 50s, I think it was. There was a whole article on that in the Journal of Scientific Exploration by Ann Druffel and two or three other authors where somebody delivered the original prints back to Rex Heflin, who was still alive. Somebody called him up one day and said, go look in your mailbox. Or, have you looked in your mailbox lately? And he said, huh, what, who's this? And the person hung up, and he looked in his mailbox. There's nothing there. But then, actually, about an hour later, he looked, and his original pictures the Air Force had taken from him in 1958 or whatever it was were in his mailbox. So they were able to... first-generation pictures, subject them to computer analysis, and determine that they were real pictures of something of the size and shape and movement that Heflin said they were, in spite of the fact that other people have said that they were faked, based on shadows, the time of day, how much moisture was in the air at the time. And the fact that there were pictures of the thing taking off later and left this huge, like, donut-shaped cloud of smoke as it took off. And there was a picture of the donut cloud of smoke as this object took off. There was just a picture of the smoke ring in the air.
Huh.
And it was quite interesting. It supported what he said, because people were saying, well, he said it did all these things. It was trailing a cloud of smoke, and suddenly it just took off at high speed and left this torus-shaped ring of smoke in the air, and he had a picture of it, and actually it had to be computer enhanced to the point where you actually see it, because you could sort of see it in the picture, but you could see it really clearly after they enhanced it. And why would he go to the trouble of hoaxing all this and then hoaxing a smoke ring in the air? You can do that.
Yeah.
At least not at the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. So that's why it's kind of, you know, it's kind of tragic that these records there's probably all kinds of gems in there.
Oh, yeah.
About that can be used now with the, you know, hindsight technology, more experience to find out which of these cases were genuine and possibly would point to some sort of answer or origin. You know, I don't know, but I think that's a really valuable area of research, is just looking at these old cases.
Well, one of the more interesting parts of the book, sort of in the mystical sense, was these orbs in Venowitz's house, because it was probably one of the few things that didn't get explained away in the book. What's the story with these orbs?
I don't know where they came from, and I don't know who made them or what they were, but... The first I heard about this is I was interviewing Bill, really interviewing, we just basically sat down for lunch and would yak. I think I brought that up. Is there anything just weird about the case that just, you know, you couldn't explain? He goes, well, there were a few things, but the one that he remembered was he was in the house one evening and he looked up at the ceiling and there was this kind of orange, amber-colored, grapefruit-sized orb of light floating up near the ceiling. kind of where the ceiling met the wall. He said you could see the corner of the corner where the ceiling met the wall through it. And he kind of went, "Hey, Paul, what is that?" And Benowitz kind of nonchalantly said, "Oh, you see them too. Yeah, they show up once in a while." And he didn't even seem to care about it. It was just like an everyday occurrence to him. He said, "Paul, do you know what these things are?" He goes, "No, but they show up every once in a while. And they go away, and I don't know what they are." And I brought this up with Richard Doty when I interviewed him. I said, "Did you ever see anything?" You know, I try not to ask leading questions because the way these people are, and also just, you know, techniques of interviewing. I said, "Is there anything going on that you could really explain and you didn't have any idea about, and it kind of leaves you baffled?" And the first thing he said was, "Yeah, those orbs in the house." I said, "Well, what orbs?" He said, "They're, you know, maybe softball or grapefruit size." And one thing he said is that they had little sparkly, like, sparkles in them. He said, but it was kind of an amber color. He said he saw them when he was in the house checking for stuff when Benowitz wasn't home and his family wasn't home. You know, they'd go in and check over his stuff and see if he had anything incriminating or anything they didn't want him to have, recordings, photographs. And they saw the things there, too. He said he was there with NSA people, and they said, "We don't know what it is either. I don't know." So that was one thing. And then something that didn't go in the book, which is exclusive to this show because I just heard it a couple weeks ago.
Awesome.
Bill said he was at the house one time at Paul Benowitz's house, and at the whole upper story of the house had been turned into this sort of tracking station and UFO detecting lab that Benowitz had built. And he had all these antennas, things pointed up at the sky towards the base, etc. And as far as I remember, the way Bill told it was, he said, "They're in the air. They're in the sky over the house right now." And Bill said, "Who?" He said, "The aliens are there right now." I said, "Well, how do you know?" So, "Well, you can see. Look." And he showed him some readout on an oscilloscope and said, "There's a disturbance in the magnetic field or whatever it is. So they're there right now." And he said, "And they're scanning you." He said, "They're scanning me." He goes, yeah, I can tell." And he said, "I couldn't tell anything." I said, "How do you know, Paul? How do you know they're scanning me?" He goes, "Well, there's a spike there in the reading, so I know that they're sending out a scanning beam." And Bill said, "Well, okay." And he said, if they want you to know they're there, they'll scan you again." And he said, "Oh, yeah?" And he said, at that point, he suddenly felt really hot, like a hot flash, and he felt kind of faint. And it lasted a few seconds, and then it was gone.
Wow.
And Paul said, "Yeah, I guess they did scan you." And Bill said, "Well, what the hell was that?" Because sometimes that happens. But I wish I had known that when I was doing the book, but he just came up with it a few weeks ago when we were talking about it.
Wow.
So that, I don't know what that is. I don't know where to put it, what box to put it in, if somebody at a government agency was doing it, if Benowitz was doing it himself, or if indeed there was some sort of alien or extraterrestrial or some other force that was doing it that Paul knew about. So there are some aspects to what he was doing that were truly unexplained and very strange, and I don't know what to make of them. Bill didn't, and other people I've talked to didn't either.
Huh.
So it's not to say everything Benowitz was into was total junk and not worthy of some sort of further investigation, if it's that's even possible. But the main parts of the story, you know, the Dulce base, the exchange of abduction rights for technology, an imminent invasion, all these things were basically capitalized upon by the Air Force and other intelligence agencies that had things going on at the base. Now, if you say, now somebody's going to hear that story and say, "Well, see, there was something going on and he wasn't full of crap." It's like, well, there's so many different parts to this story. You can't say all of it's true because that thing is unexplained or all of it's unexplained.
Exactly.
You have to take these incidents on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, I wish I had known that to put it in the book because it's truly unexplained, and somebody might be able to see that or hear it on your show now, can probably hear it on your show and might have some kind of example of something else, something similar to that, or something that might lead to some answers to what was going on around Paul's house in Albuquerque there in the 80s.
I could have sworn I read that Tesla had orbs like that in his house. at his left.
Well, I've never heard that. It wouldn't be surprising for what he was doing. I mean, he might have had created some sort of plasma.
Yeah.
Some sort of plasma balls that, you know, artificial ball lightning, if you want to call it something.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe as a result of all the electrical equipment or something. I don't know.
Maybe so. Not entirely inconceivable.
During the research, you must have heard about Doty's book, Exempt from Disclosure.
Yeah, I got a copy of it.
Okay. Is that a new book or is that an old book?
No, that's quite new. And it's not his book. Robert Collins wrote it, and Doty contributed quite a long chapter in it.
And, oh, so you're familiar with it. You probably read it, right?
I read probably about three-quarters of it.
So what? How does that jive with what you know of Doty and what he told you?
He goes into slightly more detail about what was going on with him, but I really don't have any way to prove it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of something specific. Well, he does talk about in the book about being indoctrinated kind of into the Air Force's idea about what UFOs were and where they came from and how they were dealing with them. Now, he didn't do that much. He didn't go into that much detail with me on that. In fact, when he was on Art Bell, when I was on there with him, he said he had seen films of the Roswell recovery, and they weren't the Santilli film. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know whether to believe him or not. He seems to be convinced of that, or dearly wants everybody that hears him to believe it. But he goes in a little more detail about that in the book, and his history in the Air Force and his history of the knowledge of the UFO subject while carefully not revealing what he's not supposed to. He is, in fact, actually going back into the Air Force as of the end of this month.
Oh, really?
They called him back to be in counterintelligence. He's going to go off to the East Coast somewhere, and I probably won't be able to talk to him, and neither will anybody else.
Huh.
For a while.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah, I just found that out, and I'm desperately trying to get him to talk to me for an hour or two so I can put it on my show.
Yeah, go for it.
So we'll see what happens.
All right, well, let's hit on Falcon, this mysterious character in the book. He never gets a name in the book. He's fascinating as well. He's a really fascinating character in the book. You must not have been able to find out too much information about him if you could only give him the name Falcon. So is he that mysterious that people must have seen him, but they just don't know anything about him? He's that good?
I think there's only a couple people I know of that know what his name is. Was. He's dead now.
Yeah.
Richard Doty and Bill Moore know who that guy was. Funny thing was that Bill had to find out by going through different channels, because Falcon would not tell him who he was. And I don't know what he referred to him as. I think there was like he had an alias that he used that Bill would refer to him as. He was called Falcon in the book because that's the name that Jamie Chandray and Bill gave him so that they could talk about all these people on the phone and other places without it having anybody know what they were talking about. So I just called him that in the book out of convenience sake. I am probably by the end of this year or sometime in next year, I will have a name. I'm looking into it, and, you know, these people aren't going to tell me who he is. It's that old spy game. You figure out who it is, and we'll tell you you got it.
Yeah.
So sometime in the next, you know, year or so, I think I'll be able to put a name to it. He's dead now, which doesn't do us too much good in that regard. But if I can find his name, maybe I can find out where he came from, what he was involved with, and why he was involved with the UFO subject. And at this point, I've got the strong suspicion that he didn't really care too much about the UFO subject, except in that how much it could allow him to do his job. And his job was to root out Soviet moles. And apparently he was good at it. Specifically Soviet moles, but in general security breaches. Because this was during the Cold War, and this Benowitz thing was just a tiny little part of a larger program. And Bill was just a tiny part of the Benowitz thing. And while the Air Force was trying to keep, and the NSA were trying to keep people from revealing what was going on the base, this guy Falcon was trying, using the UFO groups and the UFO subject, to try and find out who was a security risk that was on American soil, specifically from the Soviet Union, because that was the biggest bugaboo back then.
Yeah.
And when I say bugaboo, I don't mean that it wasn't a threat. I mean, there were people here. There were Russian agents here, and they were hanging around military bases. And a lot of these people that were hanging around military bases posed as UFO researchers. They said, well, all we want to know about is the strange lights flying around, but then they'd go over to these military bases and take cameras and start taking pictures. And the Air Force, understandably, didn't like this. They didn't care about UFOs. They wanted to find out what kind of secret aircraft were flying around and then send that information or take it back to Russia. So the Air Force, the NSA, CIA, all these people obviously didn't want them doing this. So using the UFO subject, they were able to root people out. I mean, this happened over and over again. I cite one example in the book where these guys were hired by, I think it was Citizens for UFO Secrecy, Peter Gersten and those people, to go and do research on the Cash Landrum case. But they actually turned out to be Soviet spies, and they were hanging around the bases asking questions, taking pictures, and saying they were UFO researchers and wanted to find out about this case, which some people may know about, that diamond-shaped thing that irradiated those three people in Texas.
Okay, yep.
They were investigating that, but then the FBI and the Air Force found out that they were actually trying to find out more about any kind of secret aircraft programs that were being conducted. And this was what Falcon was interested in. He wanted to find out who in the UFO community was not really who they said they were, not really that interested in UFOs, but more in issues of national defense, under the guise of being UFO researchers.
What was his relationship to Doty? Now, in my mind, I'm picturing he's like the Tommy Lee Jones to Doty's Will Smith, for the Men in Black reference. But
Was he
sort of like the mentor, or were they on an even playing field, or were they just from two different agencies and forced to work together?
They were from two different agencies. The AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, will work with other agencies if they have the same goal, which in this case they were. Falcon was basically running the show on this one of many different investigations and projects that AFOSI was involved in. AFOSI is basically like, you know, the police, the FBI for the Air Force. A lot of their stuff has to do with internal matters, security leaks and all that. And one of these is, you know, leaks of information to foreign governments.
Yeah.
So Falcon was basically like, you know, the FBI coming in and directing the sheriff's department of the local whatever, and utilizing them in their larger investigation.
And that would be Jody, the local.
Yeah, he was like the local sheriff, and Falcon had jurisdiction over all security at these bases. So, or at least in that case, he did on this project, and he used Jody basically as kind of a guide to carry out what he wanted to go on. I don't know if he gave him direct orders, but they worked together, and basically was much older than and higher in rank, I guess, in the large scheme of things than Doty was. So basically, Doty took his orders from Falcon in this case, in the Benowitz case.
And when you talked to Doty, was he did he begrudge Falcon? Did he even talk about him much, or was he like happy with how they worked together?
I don't know. I think Falcon kind of makes him nervous because when every time I tried to bring him up on the Art Bell show, he changed the subject.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he just didn't want to talk about him. And when I talk to him, he says, if you guess who he is, I'll tell you who he is. I'll tell you you're right. But other than that, he doesn't want to talk about him that much.
Huh.
And I don't think it's because he's scared of Falcon. I think it's because what they were dealing with at the time, and that subject still is either classified, or he thinks it's classified enough that he doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
How he's scared of Falcon still, or had any grudge against him. It was just what they were, the project they were involved in at the time was fairly high up in the secrecy ladder because of the projects that were going on at the base, which I describe in the book. You know, it's tracking Russian satellites, high-speed communication through the NSA's project, and other things that I don't even know about.
But he was never like, I wanted to do it this way, but Falcon said we had to do it that way or anything like that.
No, I think it was Falcon would say, we need to do this. And you would either tell him, do it this way, or we need to do this, bring me the results.
I see. Okay.
I mean, sometimes he would get orders, and a lot of times, in fact, I know this from another friend of mine who actually was in the AFOSI a few years after Doty. I've had him on my show a lot. His name is Walter Bosley, and he was a special agent. Basically had the same job that Doty did. So he was able to give me insight into how these projects were tasked through AFOSI if they needed to be. Like the FBI will come in and say, oh, we got a guy here, lives next to the base, has a relationship with Colonel so-and-so, and we want to know what the nature of that relationship is. So you come at it from your end, and we'll come at it from our end, but they don't give them any orders. They just say, find out what you can. They're giving a lot of leeway a lot of the time. Special agents with the AFOSI, they're giving a lot of leeway in doing what they want, which is actually some of the reason why a lot of the stuff that Doty did was kind of maverick and made his superiors kind of nervous.
Huh.
That thing with Linda Howe, I think he pretty much ran that show, and he kind of went off the page in what he was kind of allowed to do, which is why it was slightly embarrassing for them. Basically, he was just trying to shut down that HBO special that she was working on for reasons I've never been able to find out. But he took it a little further than he was supposed to, I guess, by showing her fake documents, etc.